It's a strange Old Testament commandment, that one which says, thou shalt not seethe a kid in his mother's milk. And there have been many speculations as to what the import of that statement might have been. It is interesting to notice, as we read through the Old Testament, that there is a certain idea about kindness to animals. For example, thou shalt not kill a calf, thou shalt not kill a cow and her calf on the same day. Or there is another statement, thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn. And there is built into the idea of the Old Testament a certain concept of what our attitude towards animal life ought to be. It seems as if the Hebrew were revolted by the idea of many of the Arabs who would take the newly born kid, who would slaughter it, and then would prepare it for the table in its mother's milk. And there is something about it which seems to revolt our finest susceptibilities. However, I think we need to look at the statement a little bit closer. And if we do, we may apprehend that there is some peculiar principle which is involved in this statement. The principle that I see in this statement is this, that the divine commandment is, thou shalt not take that which was meant to minister life to the newborn kid and use it to bring about its destruction. Thou shalt not seethe a kid in its mother's milk. Now it seems that this principle is particularly applicable in this whole area of sex. I would remind you this afternoon that the concept of sexuality is tied up with some of the most beautiful words in the English language. It is tied up with words like mother, home, love, babies. But rather unfortunately, it is also associated with some of the most terrible and some of the most horrible words that we have in our English language. Prostitution, rape, venereal disease, lust. All of this tells me that this remarkable capacity of human beings to reproduce themselves is a very complex matter indeed. It is something within men and women which is overladen with all sorts of emotional considerations. It is a very intricate factor of human personality. And because of this, it is comparatively easy, it is a comparatively easy matter to throw it out of gear. I think that many of us must at some time or another, as we have sat in our studies perchance, and as we have talked with young people, and as we have tried to help them with the complexities of the struggles that they face in this area of sexuality, that again and again we must have been driven back to a statement made by Martin Luther many years ago. Martin Luther, considering the complexity of it all, said on one occasion, had God consulted me in this matter, I would have advised him to continue the generation of the species by fashioning human beings out of clay as Adam was made. And I think that very often when we consider the complexity of all this, we wonder, oh Lord, was there not a more simple way that it could have all been brought to pass? Let me remind you too, that as we read through the Bible, that we discover that the Bible has a lot to say about human sexuality. It has a lot to say about the things which affect men and women. And there are many people who believe, for example, that the word sex itself came from the word six, referring to the sixth commandment in the Catholic version of the Decalogue. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Now in our day and age, we are living in a day when we are speaking about the new morality. We are talking about what some people have called the sex explosion. Or some people are telling us about relationship ethics or situation ethics. And all of these concepts are seeming to say to us, many of the old values that you've held for so long about sex are not necessarily true. It may be that you will have to go back and you will have to re-examine them, you will have to re-evaluate them, and you will have to accommodate yourself to a modern age in which men and women have come to some new conclusions about human sexuality. So this afternoon, for the few moments that I have with you, I want us to think about human sexuality and want us to think of some of the concepts of morality which are tied up with our Christian faith. First of all, I want to say that it seems that today we are facing untold confusion in trying to conclude just what human sexuality is all about. Very often we pick up a book, and as we read it, we read about a couple of people having a sexual encounter. And when we read this statement, it says they made love. And the implication seems to be that sex and love are synonyms, whereas in reality, nothing could be further from the truth. The word love itself is an umbrella term. It includes a number of ideas. You will recollect that one of the simplest ways to think about it is to take three Greek words. To take the word eros as representing selfish love, sensual love, physical love. And immediately we say that, of course, we put ourselves back in this quandary. Now let me remind you that as I say that eros or sexual love is a very important part of a total view of love, I am not saying that sex and love are the same. As a matter of fact, in many areas, they are completely different from each other. Sex is part of my body chemistry. There is a certain glandular change that takes place in my physiological makeup, and so comes to pass my apprehension of the fact of my sexuality. Love, on the other hand, is a psychological consideration. It has very little to do with body chemistry. Sex has mainly to do with one aspect of conscious process, mainly to do with the emotional. Love, at its best, does not just have to do with the emotional. It has to do with the intellectual. It has to do with the way we think. It has to do with the volitional, the way we act. And sex is fundamentally selfish. The sexually aroused person doesn't much care what happens to anybody else. That individual says, in effect, I want my satisfaction, and I'm not too concerned about anyone else. On the other hand, love at its best is a concern for someone else. The second Greek word which is used for love, of course, is the word philia, the word which has the idea of companionship, the idea of companionate love, the idea of shared interests, the idea of common goals, the idea of being together as we think about life. And the third word is the word agape, the great rich word that the Christian faith has brought to us. This word agape, which is the word which is used in the New Testament of God's love. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Love is something you do, something you put into action, something you act out. So the whole concept of love is a very, very complex one, and a part of the total concept of love is the concept of sex. It is not just a plain biological necessity. It is tied up with a whole lot of emotions that surround it in all the considerations of human beings. The second thing I want to say to you this afternoon is that we may need to stop and think for a little while about some of the ideas that are being propagated today under the idea of relationship morality. Now, it's very interesting to notice some of the statements that are being made. We are being told that almost any sort of sexual behavior is all right as long as it takes place, one quote is, within the covenant of intimacy. Another of these quotes is, it is all right as long as it is part of a meaningful relationship. And one of the tragedies we face with many of the formulations, say, of situation ethics and similar considerations is that we are presented over and over again with some exceptional situation. And we are told in this situation, if certain things were just plain right and wrong, then what would happen? Now, the fact of the matter is that most of our people are very seldom in these exceptional situations. I've often said, how does a little girl on the back seat of a parked automobile. How does she know whether this is part of a meaningful relationship or whether it is within the covenant of intimacy? She wants some pretty simple criteria by which she can evaluate whether or not she ought to be involved in this process. Now, the fact of the matter is that in all this relationship concept, we need to turn back and remind ourselves, of course, sexuality is always involved in relationships. Sexuality means that I'm involved with somebody else in an experience of life. But my sexuality does not mean that I'm just involved with one other person. Kierkegaard, in his book on sexual morality, discusses this. He comes out with an argument for a morality of relationship. He says, that which strengthens relationship is right. That which weakens relationship is wrong. And that sounds very good when you first say it. Then he goes on to point out that in the extension of this idea, there are a couple of considerations. He says, when we think of relationship, we cannot think of a relationship as just involving two people. We must remember that there are other people involved. It's like the college student that came in one day and said, yes, when I first started, I said, my sexual behavior has to do with me and no one else. It's nobody else's business. Now I have come to see, he said, that it includes Cain. And now it includes an unborn baby. And still further, it involves Cain's parents and my parents. Sexuality is always tied up with a large group of people. And when people stand up and say, my sexual behavior is my concern and nobody else's, then they have a gross misunderstanding of the social life of men and women and the way in which we live. The second thing, said Kierkegaard, that we need to consider is that I've got to ask myself, not does this strengthen a relationship at this given moment, but what will be the ultimate outcome of this? Dr. O. Herbert Marrow, discussing this, says one of the fallacies of this philosophy, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. One of the fallacies of this is that we do not die tomorrow. Tomorrow we live to see the consequences and the outcome of our behavior. And whenever we're involved in any sort of relationship, we always have to look upon the immediate situation. And we always have to ask ourselves, how does it involve other people? There is a social argument for morality. And it may be no better or no more clearly seen than in the experience of Soviet Russia. You'll recollect that in the pre-revolutionary days, wherever communists went, they were the great free lovers. They were advocating free love. They advocated, first of all, in the Communist Manifesto. Later on, it was seen to be a partner of their revolutionary movement. When the communists came into power in Russia, they did everything they could to downgrade home and family life. And amongst other things, they said that a sexual relationship was like drinking from a glass of water. But in 1935, there was a complete reversal of policy. And in that time, a series of edicts were promulgated, and by those edicts, family life was again put at the heart of Russian life. Then it was that divorce was made difficult, and then it was that sexual morality was said to be of the utmost importance. And if we want to look for the sexual Puritans today, we look for them in Soviet Russia, Communist China, North Vietnam, and the Eastern satellites. And you can do this when you can control the lives of your subjects. Someone has said you can tell a man's nationality by what he does when he meets a pretty girl. If he's an Englishman, he shakes hands with her. If he's an American, he asks her for a date. If he's a Frenchman, he kisses her. If he's a Russian, he wires Moscow for instructions. Now, how was it? How was it that a great nation decided on this course of action? It wasn't because of the influence of the Bible. It was simply because by a pragmatic experiment, a great nation wedded to the scientific ideal had found that promiscuity damages the family, first of all, and ultimately it damages the nation. The third idea that I want to mention to you real quickly is that there is, I believe, a biblical concept of sex. What does the Bible teach us about sex? Seems to me, if I may say it pretty quickly, that there are five basic ideas to be found in the Bible about sex. The first is this, that sex is creative. God said to our first parents, be fruitful and multiply. Therefore, sex is not dirty, sex is not unclean. It may in fact represent one of the noblest functions of the human personality. And men and women can take pride in the fact that God has invited them to be partners with him in his creative work. The second idea that I feel the Bible teaches is that sex is for union. It is not good for a man to be alone, declares God. In the Epistle to the Corinthians, Paul tells husbands and wives, referring to their sexual relationships, defraud ye not one another. This sexual factor helps me to realize that I am incomplete, that I need another person. This sexual factor helps to cement together this marriage bond. Now, for this reason, I completely reject the Catholic idea that sex is just for the reproduction of life. You know, I had an experience a couple of years ago that some of you may have heard about. One afternoon I answered the phone, and when I answered it, a voice said, it was a call from a little old town not far from where I live, it's called Dallas. And when I answered the phone, the voice on the other end said, this is Bishop Fulton J. Sheen speaking. Well, I've got some friends like Jess Moody and a few people around here, and I've got one fellow who regularly calls up and says, Cardinal Cushing speaking, so I thought, I wonder who this is. So I said, hi Bish, how you doing? He said, I've read your book, The Great Sex Swindle, and I'd like you to come and give some lectures at St. Bernard Seminary. I said, good, you call, I come. I'd be delighted to be with you. And so it went on. And then I said, now who is this speaking? He said, this is Bishop Sheen. I said, now I know it's not Bishop Sheen. Who is it? Is it Jess Moody? Ron Prince? Well, that's how it finished up. My son came in a bit later and I told him about it, was laughing about it. He said, Daddy, he said, I was watching TV last night and Bishop Sheen is in Dallas at this very moment. I said, oh. That night I got in touch with Bishop Sheen, and as I spoke to him, I apologized over and over again. And then I said, Bishop Sheen, does the invitation still stand? He said, yes. I said, well, it's a bit of a shame, isn't it? We're going to run into trouble when we get there. I believe in planned parenthood. I cannot help but believe in it. Sex is for union. The third idea is that sex is not to be used for exploitation. I have no right to look upon another person just as a body. I must have respect for their personality. The fourth idea is sex is not to be perverted. And the fifth idea is that sex is not to be our master. It is to be our servant. Now, the Bible has a clear idea about sex. The Bible has a lot to say about sex. And I think the time is far overdue for us to sit down, to reconsider what it says, and to take this message to the lives of our young people. And in conclusion, let me say that I am growing very disturbed about so much talk about realism in sex. I feel that if we're going to have realism in sex, we need to be able to talk to our young people in a realistic manner, pointing out some of the problems that they are going to face if they choose to walk the pathway of immorality. I think that in many of the magazines that they are reading today, many of the articles that they are paying attention to, they are being presented the most unreal view of sex that you could ever imagine. They are being presented with a view of womanhood that is one of the most tragic views that you could ever imagine. I was in England just a few weeks ago. While I was there, I was looking at a portrait of the Count of Leicester, the Earl of Leicester. The Earl of Leicester was in the court of Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth had her eye on Leicester and didn't want him to get married, but he married secretly. He had his wife hidden away in a castle. Periodically, he used to go home to see her. His wife was very dissatisfied with his existence, and the Earl was getting into a very difficult situation. Periodically, he would come back. As he went into the courtyard, he would whistle a well-known tune, and the Countess would run out to meet him. The men who were looking after the Countess grew dissatisfied with their irksome task. They often talked together what they ought to do. Then one night, as Foster was wandering round the castle, suddenly heard the sound of a horse's hoofs in the courtyard. Then he heard the well-known tune. The next moment, the Countess came running out of her room, stepped onto the trapdoor that they had outside the door, from which they had pulled the bolts, and she fell down to her death. As Foster looked down to see what had happened, he heard Varney's voice. "Did we catch the bird?" And then he realized Varney had mimicked the Earl. He turned and said, "Oh, Varney, if there is a judgment, thou hast deserved it. Thou hast killed her by her best affection. It is the seething of the kid in his mother's milk."